Hello, and welcome back once again to Surgery 101, the podcast series, website, and app brought to you with the help of the Department of Surgery at the University of Alberta. If you want to know more about Surgery 101, you want to see our extra features or videos or all of our previous episodes, just go along to surgery101.org. It's all right there. This week is our third episode in the series on inflammatory bowel disease. And in this episode, we'll be looking at biological agents. So Dr. Lana Bistritz is back, and she's explaining when we should consider treating patients with biological agents. She'll be giving you a list of three biological agents used in the management of inflammatory bowel disease. She'll be looking at their common adverse effects, and she'll be considering three current controversies relating to the use of biological agents in the treatment of IBD. So let's get ready to get a little bit biological here on Surgery 101.
Hi everyone, this is Lana Bistritz, gastroenterologist at the Royal Alexandra Hospital in Edmonton, and welcome to part three of our session on inflammatory bowel disease. So in our previous session, we talked about initial therapy for IBD, including immunomodulator therapy, and a subsegment of patients with IBD will fail to improve on these medications, and these patients will require a step up in therapy. And failure of treatment really can indicate they were refractory to the treatment that they received, particularly steroids, or the patient who becomes steroid dependent. As we talked about in the last session, steroids are associated with significant complications, so if a patient is unable to wean off steroids, that's also a failure in therapy requiring a step up. And the step up these days is usually biologic therapy. Biologic therapies are monoclonal antibodies to cytokines that are involved in the inflammatory cascade that underlies the pathogenesis of IBD. The most commonly used biologic drugs in inflammatory bowel disease are the anti-TNF agents. The ones that are available on the market include infliximab or Remicade, adalimumab or Humira, and in the United States, certolizumab or Cimzia. Infliximab is a mouse human chimeric antibody which is administered via intravenous infusion. It is administered first for induction at 0, 2, and 6 weeks, and then can be used for maintenance infusions every 8 weeks thereafter. The dose is usually 5 milligrams per kilo, and it's approved for induction or maintenance therapy for both Crohn's or ulcerative colitis. The second most commonly used medication in this class would be adalimumab or Humira. This is a humanized antibody, so there is a reduced risk of forming anti-drug antibodies, and it's administered by the patient as it's a subcutaneous injection administered every 2 weeks. It's approved for therapy for induction or maintenance of Crohn's disease, and there is evidence of effectiveness for ulcerative colitis as well. Certolizumab or Cimzia is a slightly different biologic drug. It is a human FAB fragment to tumor necrosis factor. It is administered as well subcutaneously every 4 weeks. Currently, it's approved for Crohn's in the United States, but is not approved in Canada. The other biologic drug that you may hear of is natalizumab. This is an alpha-4 integrin inhibitor which prevents leukocyte translocation to the areas involved with inflammatory bowel disease. Initially, this was taken off the market due to complications with progressive multifocal leukoencephalopathy related to the JC virus. It's now back on the market, but not as commonly used, and it's approved for Crohn's only. Obviously, these biologic drugs are incredibly expensive, and Remicade costs about $30,000 Canadian per year, so adequate drug coverage is necessary for these patients. All biologic therapies do have adverse effects, and significantly there are increased risks of infection. This is increased if the patient is on other steroids, and as I'll talk about in a minute, many of these patients are also on concomitant immunomodulators, so combined therapy would increase the risk of infection. All patients who are contemplating biologic therapy need to be screened for tuberculosis, as this can reactivate in the patient who is receiving an anti-TNF agent. And hepatitis B can also reactivate, so patients need to be screened for hepatitis B pre-therapy as well. In areas where histoplasmosis or coccidiomycosis are endemic, these fungal agents should be screened for, as they can also reactivate in the patient who is immunosuppressed. And we have seen complications relating to dental abscesses or even hematogenous spread from dental infection, so we usually recommend that the patients are seen by their primary care dentist to ensure that their dental work is up to date prior to starting biologic therapy. Patients who are on biologic therapy cannot receive live vaccines, including measles, mumps, and rubella. And female patients on biologic therapy should receive regular pap smears, as they are at increased risk of cervical cancer related to human papillomavirus. The non-infectious complications of biologic therapy can include infusion reactions or injection site reactions, or even serum sickness-like reactions related to the foreign protein involved with the biologic drug. Patients on anti-TNF agents have been known to develop lupus-like illnesses, and some patients who have no symptoms similar to lupus do still have evidence of anti-double-stranded DNA antibody formation, and we're not sure what this portends for the future. Congestive heart failure can be associated with these drugs, and in someone who has pre-existing CHF, they would be contraindicated, and there is an increased risk of CNS demyelinating diseases. Patients on biologic therapy do appear to be at increased risk of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and in particularly young men who were also taking azathioprine, there have been several reported cases of hepatosplenic T-cell lymphoma, which is almost universally fatal. Having said that, the response rates for biologic therapy in patients who have previously failed other conventional treatments are about 50% at 1 year. So these drugs do provide another alternate therapy in patients who had not responded to standard treatment. There are several debates regarding the use of biologic therapy in the IBD population. The first debate is at what point these drugs should be used, and there are two schools of thought. The first school of thought is that we may be able to change the natural history of inflammatory bowel disease and possibly prevent complications if we use immunomodulator or biologic therapies early. And this would be the top-down strategy, where we would try to get control with the biologic therapy first and potentially maintain the patient on either biologic drugs or immunomodulators. This probably would entail over-treating a segment of the population who never would have escalated to that area with traditional step-up therapy, and certainly does have an increased cost implication and possibly increased adverse effects. So at the moment, the top-down versus step-up argument continues to rage, and future studies will help to determine at what point these drugs should be used in the course of disease. The second debate in biologic therapy is use of biologic therapy as monotherapy versus with an immunomodulator. The theory behind using an immunomodulator as well is to reduce antibody formation to the biologic drug. Certainly we do know that anti-drug antibodies reduce the clinical effectiveness of these drugs, and the drugs are foreign proteins. A landmark paper called the SONIC study compared azathioprine plus placebo, infliximab plus placebo, or the combination of azathioprine and infliximab, and found that the combination was more effective in achieving steroid-free remission than either alone. So this has increased popularity of combination therapy, although certainly we are still keeping an eye out for increased adverse effects, specifically that hepatosplenic T-cell lymphoma that I talked about earlier. The other debate that is continuing to evolve in the realm of biologic therapy for IBD is what should our treatment endpoints be? So we had been treating patients with a clinical endpoint based on symptoms and possibly inflammatory markers like serum levels of C-reactive protein, but we are beginning to realize that clinical symptoms don't correlate well with the degree of endoscopic disease, and some patients who clinically are well may have continued inflammation if you were to assess them endoscopically. So the question is, should we be doing more monitoring either endoscopically or with radiologic methods to ensure that there is actually mucosal healing in the patient who feels symptomatically better? However, once you've looked and seen that there is still evidence of mucosal inflammation, that necessitates upscaling in therapy if mucosal healing has not been attained. So again, using clinical versus endoscopic endpoints is still one of the debates as far as timing of biologic therapy and use of this drug. The other medication that I wanted to mention, which is not actually a biologic therapy, but is definitely one level up from the immunomodulators we discussed in the last podcast, is cyclosporin. Cyclosporin is a calcineurin inhibitor, which has been used extensively in the transplant population. There's no role for this drug for Crohn's, but it has been used effectively as rescue therapy for patients with severe ulcerative colitis who are not responding to steroids and who would otherwise have required a complete colectomy. 80% of patients who we induce with cyclosporin can avoid a colectomy in the short term, but by a year, only 40% of them still have their colon. Cyclosporin needs to be used with steroids as well as an immunomodulator, so there is high infection risk, and these patients need to receive Septra or some other alternate PCP prophylaxis. And cyclosporin in and of itself carries an increased risk of hypertension, nephrotoxicity, and seizure, and its levels need to be monitored carefully. Because of all of these risks, this role as a rescue medical therapy is rapidly being supplanted by the anti-TNF drugs in the patients who would otherwise require colectomy for severe acute ulcerative colitis. So in conclusion, biologic agents work to counteract the pro-inflammatory cytokines that cause mucosal damage in IBD. They are effective when other standard treatments have failed. However, they do carry a significant cost burden as well as a risk of adverse effects, including increased risk of infection and possibly malignancy. And their exact timing in the treatment of IBD continues to evolve and will be guided by studies which are currently in progress.
That's it for episode 3 of our series on IBD. Next up, we'll be starting to talk about surgical management of the condition. As always, we're very keen to hear from our listeners about what you think of our episodes and about new topics you want, so please have a look at surgery101.org. We can get all of the extra stuff and contact us there through surgerypodcast@gmail.com or like our Facebook page or send us a tweet on Twitter. And as always, you can purchase the Surgery 101 app and Surgery 101 notes, and those are great ways to support us on a non-profit basis. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you back here next week on Surgery 101.